All right, as we noted last week in this particular section, and actually I guess we could look at the whole book like this. It's based on 1 Timothy 3, verses 14 through 16. Paul says, I'm hoping to come shortly, but I'm writing these things to you so that if I'm delayed, what would you know?
How to conduct yourself.
Okay, how you or how evangelists or how things should be conducted in the house of God or the church. Oh, thank you. I thought, he can't have a comment. He hasn't said anything. There we go. All right. And so what we're doing is we're going through and we're looking at the work of an evangelist and doing the work of an evangelist and how things should be conducted in the house of God. Now, in verse 23, I think this is more of a personal comment to Timothy, but it's also a very important part of being an evangelist, and that is, when you're in the public eye and people are watching your every move and you're trying to be a good example for people, is it possible to go too far? To push yourself to where you're living kind of a Spartan life or kind of a life that God really didn't want a preacher to live or God's people to live? And I think this is a good example of that. Timothy, even in a day and age where wine was a common beverage, and a lot of times it wasn't even alcoholic, but you could never tell. If you've got a guy with a glass full of maroon-colored material, what are you going to know about it? Nothing. Nothing. You can't tell. It's like if I go into a bar and I'm drinking a 7-Up, and is there any alcohol in it or not in a bar? See, I wouldn't do that. There's no way. Well, I wouldn't be in a bar in the first place, but if I was in a bar, the last thing I'd do is have a champagne glass with 7-Up in it, because what would everybody be thinking? He's drinking champagne, or he's drinking vodka in his 7-Up. So Timothy had a concern that people might see him drinking even non-alcoholic wine, and so he decided, what would he do?
Drink only water.
He's just going to be a water drinker. It's all I'm ever going to drink is water. I don't know when he made this decision, but it'd be like today if somebody said, I'm never going to drink any alcohol. I'm not going to use alcoholic mouthwash. I'm not going to take NyQuil. I'm not going to take any pain medicines that would affect my thinking because I don't even want to get close to it. What would you tell a guy like that if he's getting ready to go in for open heart surgery? You going to be able to keep that?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to have to take some medicine. You're going to need some morphine, or you're going to need some things that are going to affect your mind, but that's not why you're taking it. So that's kind of the situation here. No longer drink only water, but use a little wine for your stomach's sake and for your frequent infirmities. So is there any basis here for social drinking?
No.
Absolutely none. It is a little wine for your stomach's sake and for your frequent infirmities. So what do we call this? A medicinal use, right? George and then Virgil. Right, and that's certainly possible, but what does that tell us about Timothy's convictions about not drinking it if drinking it's going to lead to sickness?
He'll do it anyway.
He's not going to do it. He is absolutely not going to do it. I don't care if I'm sick. I don't care if I have frequent infirmities. I'm going to drink water. And so Paul says, Timothy, you're being too harsh here. You're going too far. So here's what I want you to do. And as I said, this is not something that we would take to heart today because we don't have this particular situation. But again, there are things that people do. Preachers and their wives live in a fishbowl. This is something that we became aware of very early in preaching. And so you have to be careful that you don't have a better car than anybody else or you don't have a nicer house than anybody else because that's the way things are. But that's not something you really need to be concerned with. Okay, Virgil?
This passage and also the Jesus' first miracle are two of the what they call approved passages of the social drinker. And this one here particularly, after it's all shelled out, everyone that I know that has used it is backed out of it because it's not applicable if using the argument that most of them use is that it's for an ailment, but this is the proof that you can drink socially. The problem is that if somebody's going to stand on that argument, then the only people that can do that is sick people, not anybody that is well.
Right.
So if you got 100 people, probably two of them.
So next time you and your friend have a cold, then you can get together, right?
Yeah, that's about it. That's how silly the argument is.
Yeah, it is. Okay, beginning then in verse 24, I think we come back to verse 22, do not lay hands hastily on anyone. And so he says in verse 24, some men's sins are clearly seen or clearly evident, preceding them to judgment, but those of some men follow after. So what would be an example of a sin that's clearly evident?
Someone who's a drunkard.
Okay, a drunkard. How about that Corinthian fornicator? Was that pretty evident?
Yeah.
Yeah. How about those people in 2 Thessalonians who wouldn't work? And so Paul said, withdraw from them. Was that a pretty evident sin? Coming to the church wanting help because they weren't working anymore? Carl?
We take the same example. A man who drinks, but he drinks secretly.
Right, and that would be the second thing.
Yeah.
And there are people like that. There are people who know how to get away with their sin. And if that occurs, Paul just states it as a fact. One of the things I think we need to be really careful of, does God want his people to be private investigators going through people's trash and spying on people to see whether they're doing anything? Is that? I mean, do we have to be that pure? Do we have to go that far? Absolutely not. God knows if those things come out. As I pointed out last week in our sermon, love believes all things, puts the best motive on all things, and Paul said, judge nothing before the time. So unless something comes out, so these sins that are clearly evident would be all sins that people commit that become public. And because they become public, they need to be dealt with, but other sins, you can't see them. And so what does God want us to do with that? It goes before them into judgment. It follows them into the judgment. Carl?
I used to have a problem with love believes all things. And with further study, it simply means that love gives the benefit of the doubt.
Exactly. Yeah. Love always gives and puts the best possible motive on why something was done instead of the worst.
Until a situation is proven wrong.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, when somebody comes up to you and says, you know, all these years you were in doubt as to whether I don't like you or not, so I'm going to let you know I don't like you at all. Well, then, now we don't have to wonder. People don't usually do that, but if they did, then you could do that. But if they never say that, then even if you don't think they do, what should you be thinking? Well, I got to give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they just don't know how to conduct themselves and put themselves forward in a nice way. They may really like me. But those are the kind of things that that love will do. Love will make mental gymnastics to try to put the best possible motive on what people are doing until, as I said, until we just are forced to go a different direction. All right, and in verse 25, likewise, or in the same way, the good works of some are clearly evident. How about Barnabas selling his property? That was pretty evident. How about Dorcas with her good works and alms deeds? Can you hide something like that? You're giving somebody a sweater and somebody else a garment and this and this and this and this. After you've given 50 people, is it easy to hide? No, everybody knows about it. But this brings in something. What did Jesus say about good works? About doing alms and giving and fasting and praying?
Do them in secret.
Praise.
I'm sorry?
Men shouldn't do alms for the purpose
of
praise.
Okay, you shouldn't do them to be seen. So, and there's people that are like that. They want to do a good work, but they want to make sure the congregation finds out about it. And so they will find a way to bring it out. And sometimes, as Paul points out, those that are otherwise cannot be hidden. So those good works that are not clearly evident, they're still going to come out. Because as Jesus said, let your good works be seen by men so that you can what? Let your light shine. Yeah. Carl?
I heard it said that let your light shine. Don't shine your light.
Okay, yeah. That's a good. You're passive, you're not active. If people see it, fine. If they don't see it, God saw it. But if your general character is one of giving and giving and giving and giving, then even if you're not talking about it, what are people knowing? Now, that's what he always does. And even if I don't hear exactly what happened this week, I know something happened because that's just the character of this particular individual. All right, I think that's enough for chapter 5. Any other comments or questions on that? Okay, then, let's move into chapter 6. And chapter 6 is a very difficult, the first two verses are very difficult because with our recent history of slavery and the attitudes towards slavery, this verse almost seems to be inappropriate. So what I went ahead and did, because we're going to be dealing with a lot of different information here, I went ahead and printed out my material on, well, I guess you could, you can't get out. So the final chapter, and again, it just pretty much follows the same line of reasoning, which is how you ought to conduct yourself in the house of God. So how should slaves and masters conduct themselves? How should we deal with people who will not consent to sound words? what do we do with people who want to be rich or have a love of money? And then some personal exhortations to Timothy, and then in verses 17 through 19, instructions to wealthy Christians, and then finally the last words that Paul has for Timothy. So our first point, and let's go ahead and let's have Michael, you want to read that for us, first chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. You probably won't find it there. You're going to have to read that one out of your Bible.
But as many bondservants that are under the yoke count their own masters worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and his doctrine may not be blasphemed. And those who have believing masters, let them not despise them because they are brethren, but rather serve them because those who are benefited are believers and beloved. Teach and exhort these things.
Okay, so was there slavery in the first century? Yeah, it was endemic. It was everywhere. Rome would conquer a nation. It would take those people who were left alive and it would sell them to various nations. And so as Paul and the apostles went out preaching in all the world, they would find people who had servants. And so this had to be dealt with. What is supposed to happen when a Christian is converted? And so this again, let me just kind of, I'm going to read several of the paragraphs in my paper this morning. So let's look at that paragraph under number one, how Christians are to conduct themselves. It says, because of the history of slavery in our own country, many have strong feelings about it. Yet as with all other subjects, we must bring the scriptures to our own ideas and not the other way around. God has addressed this in both covenants, but not as a moral evil in itself. Its abuse is always a sin, but the activity itself is not. Under the old covenant, God sanctioned it both in war and in commerce. So you can't argue. Let's go ahead and, Virgil, you want to read that verse for us, Leviticus 25, 44 through 46.
Okay. And as for your male and female slaves whom you have, or whom you may have, from the nations that are around you, from them you may buy male and female slaves. Moreover, you may buy the children of the strangers who dwell among you, and their families who are with you, which they beget in your land, and they shall become your property. And you may take them as inheritance for your children, after you to inherit them as a possession. They shall be your permanent slaves. But regarding your brethren, the children of Israel, you shall not rule over one another with vigor.
Okay. So, what do we see about slavery under the Old Covenant? Did God condemn it?
It was allowed.
Excuse me?
It was allowed.
Okay. Virgil?
Yeah, I was going to say that. You know, when we first started our Bible questions work, we got a lot of questions about slavery. I can't remember now 14 years ago if there was something going on in the society at the time, but I can remember answering maybe one month, something like that. And like we're reading here,
It wasn't condoned or condemned, especially in the New Testament. It was regulated.
Right.
It is what it was. And I always closed by what I had to say is that we live now and we abide by, and even in the world, the golden rule is taught. Why would a person want to own somebody else? That does not make good sense nowadays.
Yeah, no, nowadays it doesn't. But does it exist in the world today?
Yes.
Yeah, it exists. And if an evangelist comes into that community and condemns slavery as an evil, is that going to fly very well?
No.
Is that part of the gospel? See, that's not part of the gospel. The gospel will accomplish that. I think you've all heard that argument, that if the gospel, the more people have God's principles in their heart, the less likely they are to have slaves. And if they do have slaves, they're going to treat them so well. That, and even the Hebrews had that situation. Remember the situation where there's a man who has a slave, and that slave doesn't want to be made free. He wants to stay with that man. He wants to be under that man's protection and under that man's guidance. And so they take a nail or an awl and put him by the door, and what do?
Put a hole through his ear.
No, they nail him to the door. They put the hole through the ear, but the thing goes into the door. Carl?
We have an example of that in Philemon, Onesimus.
Right. Yeah. So, slavery itself, and unfortunately, I'm not going to do that. That'll get me in trouble. So, let's just continue with the teaching here. Now, I'm not going to read them all, but you can see all the scriptures at the bottom of page 1 and the top of page 2. There's just a lot of scriptures in the New Testament about slavery. None of them condemn it. None of them really teach that it's wrong or an evil. And Paul actually says in 1 Corinthians, we'll go ahead and read that passage, the very first one here. It says, were you called while a slave? Don't be concerned about it. If you can be made free, rather use it. For he who was called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Now, what does that mean? How can those who are slaves be the Lord's freedman while those who are free are the slaves of Christ?
Different master.
Okay. All right. So the freedman, who's in control of his time? Well, he is, but in this case, what does it say? He is Christ's
freedman.
No, the second part. He who is called while free is
Christ's slave.
Christ's slave. So Christ will regulate your conduct. Is anybody not a slave in this world? No, we're all slaves. If you're a Christian, you're a slave of Christ. And the translators, for whatever reason, the Greek word doulos is the word that is primarily used for slave, whereas the word that we're more familiar with is the diakoneo, or deacon, which is serving out of love and care and concern for the person you're serving. Doulos means you don't have any choice, you're a slave. And Paul often calls himself this word, but the translators use servant for both, so we don't really get to see the distinction which should have. And so when it says where you call while a slave, it's that doulos, and often Paul will say, Paul, an apostle, and doulos of Jesus Christ, a slave of Christ. Now, if I'm a slave, though, now, who's in control of my time?
The master.
The master is. However, am I not being a good servant of Christ if I serve my master? No, that is being a good servant of Christ. So what a slave would do in his service for Christ is he would serve his master. That's why he's the Lord's freedman, because a lot of the commands that Jesus would have us fulfill, can a slave do them? See, a slave can't always do it. Could a slave be given to hospitality? It'd be kind of tough, wouldn't it? Could a slave be an elder in the church? Probably not, because he wouldn't have the time, he wouldn't have the ability to accomplish that. Okay, anyway, let's go ahead and move on. Okay, so again, you can read all this later if you want to. It's not germane to what we're trying to accomplish right now. So let's look at verse 1. Let as many bondservants or servants as are under the yoke. Now, the as many is the same word we were talking about for the last 2 weeks in our sermon. It's the word osos. Remember, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are just. Osos means magnitude or extent or number, and it means it just broadens it out to whatever. So every single servant, don't care what your situation is, and there's lots of situations out there. You remember what Peter said to the servants in chapter 2? He said that you should serve them not only to the good and gentle, but what? To the froward, or the Greek word is scolios. If you have scoliosis, what does that mean?
Curvature.
Okay, your back is curved. It's twisted. It's not the way it should be. Are there people out there that are twisted? Yeah. If you have one for a master, is life going to be easy? No, it's going to be brutal. Some of us have had, I've had some bosses that were like this. But you still have to respect them. You still have to do what they say. Or you can quit. I guess that's the difference between our slavery and their slavery. There's really no difference. If you contract with somebody for an 8-hour day, all through that day, what are you?
They're slave.
They're their slave. Their time, you do everything they tell you to do. Now, when you clock out, though, now you're not their slave anymore. But in the first century, you couldn't do that. All right, so every servant under every possible circumstance who is under the yoke. Now, why would Paul put under the yoke after he's just said slaves? Well, does it tighten it up a little bit more? If you're a slave and you're under a yoke, what does that mean?
You have to do some hard work.
Okay. I'm sorry?
Like you owe your master something?
Okay, well, what's a yoke?
Severe burden.
Okay, severe burden. Burden?
A yoke is something that is used with an animal to control.
Okay.
And if you're a slave and you're under a yoke, you're under more in extreme control by your master.
Exactly. So,
that's all.
Okay. So under the yoke just specifies and makes it very clear that the servants that I'm talking about here are the servants who are yoked to another human being as their slave. And they can't break that yoke. And so they're under the yoke. They are slaves. Now, if I was a slave and my master became a Christian, what would I expect him to do pretty quickly?
Treat you better.
Treat me better or... let me go, right? I mean, one man shouldn't be a slave of another man. So first thing I'm going to think is, well, he's a Christian now. He's going to let me go. What if he doesn't? Well, now I start getting a little bitter, right? A little frustrated, a little angry. But Paul's going to deal with that. And there's a specific reason for doing it. Carl, you're shaking your head. Is there something like...
No, oh. I was going to say, you still treat him as a master.
Okay, you still...
you have a duty. Like today, when we hire on, we have a duty to obey the orders of the company. Whatever the supervisor hired us to do, that's what we should do.
Right.
Be on time, be trustworthy, et cetera.
Right. You know. Charles?
Yeah, and in that scenario right there, is the slave a Christian and the master is a non-Christian in that scenario?
This scenario?
Yeah, in that scenario.
I think both are in this scenario, because look at verse 2. Those who have believing masters.
Masters, okay.
So they're both in there.
Okay, so in other words, we're saying that both are Christians.
In one case, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so what I'm saying is, or what I'm asking about, if the slave is a Christian and the master is not a Christian, then that scenario would be that you should treat me better. If you become a Christian, if the master becomes a Christian.
Well, yeah.
Because I already know that it's wrong for you to have me as a slave. But now, if the slave is not a Christian, he wouldn't know one way or the other. All he would know is that he's being treated cruelly. That's all.
Okay, that's true.
Right.
The only thing that you said there that I guess I would have to at least clarify is, is it wrong for him to keep him?
No.
Because if it was wrong for a Christian master to keep his servant, then what would Paul have to say?
You have condemned it.
You've got to let him go.
Let him go, yeah.
Right.
But what it says, say in Ephesians, let me see, I got this on page three. I don't know, on page two, I think. Probably, but yeah, it's on page one. I've probably been faster just to turn to it. Okay. Ephesians, the very second to the last verse there, and let's don't read the first part, but Charles, why don't you read verse 9?
Okay, verse 9 says, "And you masters, do the same thing to them, giving up threatenings, knowing that your own master also is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him."
Okay, so does he command the servant or the master to let them go?
No.
No. So, and Christianity, well, let me not get ahead of myself. Let's just keep going here. We'll just kind of leave it like that. Carl?
Well, if that was the case, see, Paul would have sent Onesimus back to Philemon.
Right. Right. That's true. Okay, so, Charles, does that answer your question?
Yeah, it answered it. I mean, I still have thoughts about that.
Okay.
I really do. And if someone wants to talk to me about that, they can do that also, too.
Well, we can do that later. Yeah. Maybe after this class, your thoughts will be different. We'll see.
Well, you know,
maybe not.
You know, whenever you I know we try not to get into that dark area of our lives, because that was a dark area of our lives right there. And we're trying to do this as Christians, not go back to that point in time in our lives right there. But, I mean, there were a lot of things that was just wrong about the whole situation. And I'm not going against what the Bible is saying. You know, I mean, I know what the teachings are. But, you know, I had a conversation with an individual a while back about that. Says, you know, if you had lived back during that time, if you were a slave during that time, you wouldn't have wanted to be in that period of time right there. And we kind of went on and on and on about this and everything, you know. And this was a white man that was talking to me about if he had lived back during that time, you know, just the things that went on, you know, during that time.
Right.
I mean, because it goes to other levels. You know, you have females involved. You have a lot of things that's involved right there. So that's a dark period of time right there in all of our history, you know. So.
And we would condemn the abuses. But if I was preaching in 1850 and a slave came to me and said, "I want to run away from my master," and if I read this verse to him, what would I have to say?
No,
you can't.
You can't do that. You must remain. Now, I don't like that. You don't like that. But when the script, that's why I said in the very beginning, if our feelings run contrary to the scriptures, what do we have to do?
Change.
We have to change our scriptures?
No, we don't change the scriptures.
Okay, we have to change our feelings.
Right.
And so, yeah. But you know, I don't know that every slave at that time, it was a dark time for them. I think there were a lot of masters, from what I've read, that were very good to their slaves. And I've actually read where slaves were crying when they had to leave that because, as I said a moment ago, if I have a master who's protecting me and I trust him and he's helping me and he's feeding me and I know that if I have to leave that, I'm going to go into poverty and nobody's going to care about me or take care of me, is that a good thing? So, and from our perspective, we might say, well, absolutely not. But, you know, even though slavery was broken, it took almost 100 years before those people who were freed from being slaves were treated very well. And so whether that was the best way to do it, a war where hundreds of thousands of people were killed, you know, looking back on that, we talk about it like it was a wonderful thing. I'm not sure that right decisions were made there. But I'm really glad we're where we are now. But when you look at it from a scriptural perspective, does Paul say that people should go to war to free slaves? Christians should go to war to free slaves? Absolutely not. Christians on the south were killing their Christian brothers on the north. You see where it got to. It was horrible. And so, yeah, it was a very dark time in our history. And I don't know how to judge it. It's just something that I grieve over it. You know, when you look at all the terrible things that occurred, and yeah, one good thing came out of it, but it took a long time for it to come. Carl?
I dimly remember, and maybe you can correct me, or somebody, that somewhere in the scriptures it says that the slave was more worthy than the son in inheritance.
Yeah, there's a proverb, I can't think of where it is right now.
Yeah.
You treat your slave like he's a son, then in the end, he will become more like a son.
Right.
Something along that line. Virgil?
It's in Proverbs.
Yeah.
Even in the years that we live now, there is a lot of abuse of humans that we don't even realize or know about until it surfaces. And a lot of it is what we call the sex trade,
right,
that takes place.
Yes.
Another one is the low-paid positions where they're under the what we call under the radar, such as many of the seamstresses and that manufacture clothing in the world nowadays,
right,
are treated horrible. So all people have been subject to the abuse of other people.
Right.
And somewhere along the line, many times we have to do our best to overcome those things if we're going to be Christians.
Right.
And hopefully the people that is involved in it, I'm reminded of the song, The Amazing Grace. And the writer of that song, as it is reported, wasn't necessarily a slave trader himself, but he worked on a ship that transported slaves. And the gist of this song that he ended up authoring was brought about by the abuse that he's seen and the opportunities that he had for himself to become a Christian. And it's really a beautiful song when you look at it that way and look at where it came from.
Right.
Now, whether, I'm not saying that this man, Newton is his name, was a Christian. I'm not saying that. But the gospel, the teaching of the gospels obviously had an effect on him.
Right. Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Let's go through the material, then we'll draw some conclusions. And we're kind of putting the cart before the horse here. So let's see what Paul actually says, and then we will have to apply it to our circumstances because all New Testament teachings have to be properly applied to the circumstances of today. So, in verse 1, it says, let as many as, and again, that means every single one throughout the Roman Empire, regardless of how miserable their situation, regardless of how good their situation, they must consider or count or view their own master as worthy of all honor. Now, if you have a master who's treating you like dirt, is that an easy command? But then, are there husbands that are miserable husbands and the wife still has to submit and treat them with honor? So, nothing's really changed here. What we're trying to accomplish, and the real goal here, I think, is set up in verse 1 where it says, the name of God and his doctrine may not be blasphemed. I must take into consideration the consequences of me being a bitter, angry, frustrated master, I'm sorry, slave, trying to convert my master. Is that going to work? You know, I'm rude to him, I'm not submissive to him, I don't work hard for him, but I've become a Christian and I want to show him that Christianity is the way to go. How's that going to work out? See, so the goal here is not to have fairness. Did Jesus have fairness when he was crucified? No, the goal wasn't fairness. The goal was salvation. And the goal was salvation not just of a few, but of everyone, including these miserable, ungodly, wretched masters who are mistreating their servants. And Paul isn't justifying the masters. But Rome was one of the worst countries when it came to the laws that they had. And yet, what did Paul tell us to do in Romans 13?
Obey.
So you have to obey. Now, for us, that's easy. We live in a democracy. It's pretty easy to obey the government in our culture. But in Rome, it would have been much more difficult. But you have to step through the minefield. You know, obviously Peter said you must obey God rather than men if they ask you to do something wrong. But the point is that a Christian must be the best servant, the best citizen, the best husband, the best wife as they can be, and regardless of outside circumstances. So you must deem or consider your master as someone who has honor. Now, again, that's hard to do when he's not an honorable man. We don't honor him. Remember when Paul was struck in the face by the high priest? And he said, you whited wall, which means you're a tomb. You're full of dead men's bones. And somebody on the side said, do you revile God's high priest? And what does he do immediately? He says, I didn't know. I'm sorry. Now, did he say he was sorry that he was wrong? No, he was a whited wall. But he shouldn't have said it. In other words, you respect the office, not the person in the office. Carl, was it your hand?
This kind of reminds me of something that happened when I was working for United, and they went on strike. And my union come to me and asked me to walk the picket line. I told them, I can't do that. I'm a Christian. And my company didn't put me out of work. The union did. So I would be contrary to God's law in defiling my company's orders when they want me to work. And I'm going to say no. I obey God rather than man. And I told him I will not walk that picket line. And I didn't.
All right. So coming back to the real heart of this matter is some of these masters are totally unworthy of any respect at all. But because God wants his doctrine not to be blasphemed, he wants servants to become better and better after they become a Christian, not worse, not more bitter, not more angry. So his command is that every servant under every circumstance must deem, consider, and treat their own master worthy. And the Greek word worthy here is that axios. It's the one, it's the same one that's used of the Lord's Supper. If you take the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner, or have your walk worthy of the gospel, it's the idea of a balancing scale, and whatever the responsibility is on this side, what are you doing? You're bringing up the beam. That's actually the literal definition of this word, to bring up the beam of the scale. So the weight on this side, how do I bring that beam up? Well, I fulfill the responsibilities until what I'm supposed to do and what I'm doing are equal. So you must deem or consider your masters to be worthy of all honor. Now, again, that's a difficult command, because the word honor here means that you are giving him respect and veneration and deference and reverence. In other words, you're treating him like he is worthy of all honor. Now, once again, this is how people conduct themselves in the house of God. And it's exactly what God expects. So regardless of the character, what has to happen? So if I was preaching during this dark time in American history, and I was in the South, and my responsibility was to be a preacher, and I'm dealing with this verse, what do I have to tell the slaves? Even though my heart might not be in it at all, what do I have to tell them? See, I don't have any choice. This is one of those situations where faith forces us to do things that we would not normally do. This goes against the grain. This goes against everything really that we stand for as a country. I mean, our Constitution says all men are created equal, and they have inalienable rights to pursue, and they can pursue their own freedom and their own destiny. And yet, we're living in a culture where that's only true of a certain class of men. And so, yeah, you'd want to get up. You'd want to be an abolitionist. You would want to fight this thing. You'd want to get up and preach that the slaves should be freed. But can we? See, that's the problem here. Because when you start preaching that, then people are going to start taking you at your word, and they're no longer going to fulfill this. So we have to be measured. We have to be careful. And so that's why I'm taking this perspective, and it's just so critical, because what's at stake here, the word "so that" means this is the intent, this is the end, this is the purpose, this is why it's done. It's not done because it's right or wrong. It's not done because we like it or we don't like it. It's not done because it makes us feel good or it makes us feel bad. It's done so that God will not be blasphemed. And so let me read this paragraph on the middle of page 4, right under "so that" the name. It says, "God wanted even the most cruelly treated slave to give his master the highest honor, to show the great power that Christianity wields over its followers. It makes them do things that nothing else could possibly make them do. Consider the power of Christianity in the eyes of a master who witnessed such a great change in his slave. His slave begins to give him honor, reverence, and respect, obeying his every command, getting the work done, getting more work done than ever before. This is going to have an impact. I consider the opposite scenario. The slave becomes a Christian and suddenly becomes a worse and more rebellious servant." So you see what can happen. And you see the problem is that God has to weigh out two things: the evils of slavery on the one hand, and the power of his gospel and his name on the other. Which is more important, my comfort or God's name? The salvation of souls or my prosperity and ease and my life? And so the one tends toward selfishness, the other tends toward a love of God and a love of the lost. And so Paul became all things to all men. And one of the things that he told the slaves are, if you to become all things to all men, you have to stay in that situation and you have to treat that situation like that's how it's supposed to be. And you have to respect the person who is over you. I see him. Yeah. Carl?
It comes back to the old phrase, it's not about me.
Yeah, it's not about me. And of course, it's easy for us free people to look back on that and say, well, here's what I would do if I was in that situation. That wouldn't be easy at all. But it is something that this is what has to be. And notice verse 3. "Anyone teaches otherwise and does not consent to wholesome words, even the words of our Lord Jesus Christ, and to the doctrine which is according to godliness, he is proud, knowing nothing, and obsessed with disputes and arguments over words." Now, I understand that verses 3 and 4 is more global, but with that word "if," we're not leaving that behind. These two commands here regarding the master-slave relationship, if you teach something else and don't consent to the wholesome words that have been revealed here, even the words of Jesus, then God take a good view of that? No? You're proud? Why would I be proud if I disagreed with God on the subject of slavery? Why would that make me proud? Okay, disagreeing with God is arrogant. I mean, it's a foolish thing to do. Let God be true and
every man a liar.
Every man a liar. God has revealed, and my only choice is to consent. I mean, what is faith? Is faith consent? Yeah, trusting God. And like I said, if I tell my kids when I leave the house for an hour and I want to see how obedient they are, if I say, eat all the ice cream you want, and I come home and they're all gone, boy, these are obedient children. Is that correct? No. But if I tell them, mow the lawn, clean your room, and four or five other things, and get under the sink and clean it out, and do something that's very gross, now, if they do it, what do I know? They didn't want to do that. Now, there's lots of commands in the scriptures that we love. This is not a command that anybody can love. So it's one of those commands that if you respect it and you do it, then what are you showing God?
He's first.
He's first. And if you teach otherwise, you're not consenting to wholesome words. Now, these don't sound like wholesome words to some people. The word "wholesome" here is the Greek word that we get hygiene from. It means sound. It means healthy. It means strengthening. So, all right, well, we'll stop there. I apologize because I really wanted to lay enough. If you want to, read through the material. That way next week we can talk a little bit more about some of these things. And when you read through the material, read through it with a highlighter and cross out anything you think shouldn't be there, because I'm really curious. I tried to go through and make sure it was very non-controversial. So, but I'm curious what you think about it. So let me know. All right. Thank you.